Hi, and welcome to Communicating Climate Change, a podcast dedicated to helping you do exactly that. I'm Dickon, and I'll be your host as we dig deep into the best practices and the worst offences, always looking for ways to help you and me improve our abilities to engage, empower, and ultimately activate audiences on climate-related issues. This time, instead of chatting to a special guest, listeners just like you are joining the conversation. It's a call-in show. Over the last couple of months, all kinds of voice messages have been submitted by listeners to act as a springboard for brainstorming, problem solving, and broader discussion around a range of climate communication challenges, observations, and questions. Through the course of this episode, we'll dig into a number of them, exploring themes like greenwashing, backfire effects, and some other fundamentals of the craft. But we won't just be pointing out flaws and failures. This is a show about solutions. So I'll be looking to a kaleidoscope of disciplines and perspectives, as well as the wisdom of previous Communicating Climate Change podcast guests, to find a path forward in each case. If you want to leave a voice message of your own, whether to respond to a topic discussed in this episode or to raise a new one for consideration for the next call-in show, just head over to the call-in show page at communicatingclimatechange.com or follow the link in the show notes. It couldn't be easier to get involved. Anyway, let's get on with it. Here comes our first call.
Hi, Dickon. My name's Ellie Field, and I'm Sustainability Strategy Director at Sydney Sustainability Consultancy Future Focus. I ran a little Greenwash of the Week series on LinkedIn, posting examples of greenwashing I've seen out and about for people to discuss. I'm based in Australia, but this week I posted an example I saw on a recent trip back to London. Advertised on a sign outside a London steak restaurant was a quote from a magazine calling it one of the most sustainable restaurants. Put quickly into context, the restaurant's website does show it has a clear social and environmental sustainability strategy, from targets on employing members of disadvantaged communities to MSC certified seafood and choosing locally sourced produce. However, it's a steak restaurant. My feeling is that advertising a restaurant that sells beef and imports it halfway across the world from Argentina as one of the most sustainable options is disingenuous. The science is very clear on the devastating impact of the beef industry and that we should be consuming less. I'd love to know your thoughts. Is this greenwashing or just opportunistic marketing?
Thanks to Ellie for sharing this one. So, simply put, greenwashing is the act of misleading people, whether intentionally or accidentally, about how environmentally friendly a company or its products are. In this case, we've got a restaurant, part of a steakhouse chain, that has a sign outside it that quotes a magazine as saying it's one of the most sustainable restaurants. Even in this seemingly simple example, there are quite a few layers for us to get through. Now, the UK's Advertising Standards Agency, the ASA, states that, quote, the basis of an environmental claim must be clear, end quote. So the biggest question I have is, where's the basis for the claim? Where's the data or the certification or another method of verification that I can use as someone who has seen this sign while walking by to understand the claim? If we can't access that in order to check and verify the claim, then yes, this is greenwashing. Even if we accept that this claim is legitimate, that this place really is one of the most sustainable restaurants, if there's no data or other point of reference available for the audience to verify the claim, then there can be no claim. So this would still be greenwashing, even if they were indeed a quote-unquote sustainable restaurant. To understand more about the UK's greenwashing standards, we can take a look at a few examples from the past. The ASA keeps an amazing database of all cases. So if this is your kind of thing, you should definitely check it out. One example we can look to is actually raised in the Creators for Climate Greenwash Watch training, highly recommended by lead trainer Jill Wilson. It involves an ad from Alpro showing a carton of oat milk surrounded by thousands of loose oats, along with the message, good for the planet oats. I've put a link to the ASA's documentation of this case in the show notes. In this example, no substantiation of the claim was provided in the ad. Presumably, the idea was that Alpro's plant-based products have a lower environmental footprint than their dairy counterparts. But whether that's true or not, with no basis for the claim provided to the audience, the claim was not seen as legitimate and the ad was banned. Another example from the end of 2023 involves BrewDog, a UK-based brewer. BrewDog also had an ad censored by the Advertising Standards Agency for failing to back up their claims about the carbon-negative credentials of their beer. In this case, the Advertising Standards Agency explained, quote, "Although we acknowledged that the ad referred consumers to a link for the BrewDog website which contained further information about their carbon reduction and offsetting project, we considered that the ad itself did not include information which explained the basis of the claim. Without that information, we considered that consumers would not have sufficient information to understand the basis of the environmental claims in the ad." End quote. So here, the issue wasn't that BrewDog was making the claims without having the data to back them up. Unlike the Alpro case, BrewDog had actually made the basis of the claim available for the audience. The issue here was that the ASA felt there were too many steps to take to reach that information. Sending people to a link in bio wasn't good enough. The ad was banned. But back to our restaurant example, I think we can safely say that they are indeed greenwashing here. No basis for their claims is provided, therefore there can be no claims. But wait a minute, isn't the quote from the magazine enough? Isn't that the basis of the claim? Isn't that a proxy for any other kind of data we might be looking for? Well, no. The Advertising Standards Agency states, quote, "Testimonials alone do not constitute substantiation, so marketers should not rely on testimonials as support for any direct or implied claims made in their marketing communication," end quote. It's still greenwashing. Okay, but maybe this is just a clumsy piece of marketing. Maybe the restaurant has got some legitimate grounds, as BrewDog did, for making this kind of claim and just needs to join the dots for the audience a bit better. You never know. Maybe the article that the quote is from can help us understand the basis of the claim. Well, I found the article. It's about the most sustainable restaurants in London. So already we're losing some important context in the quote that the restaurant has chosen to use in its marketing, which removes a sense of scale about the claim in a way that could be seen to be deceiving passers-by into thinking that the restaurant was one of the most sustainable ever, rather than just in London, which the article actually suggests. The Advertising Standards Agency says, quote, "Advertisements must not mislead consumers by omitting material information," end quote. I assume that the restaurant's omission of "in London" would be considered material here, so not a great start. But what else did this article say? Well, it explains that the steakhouse chain has drastically refreshed their approach to sustainability. They have a plan to work directly with farmers in Argentina to reduce carbon emissions at the source, and that any remaining carbon emissions are offset through reforestation projects. There's also a quote-unquote sustainable drinks program offering biodynamic, organic and natural wines, quote-unquote dramatically reducing their carbon footprint. The company also claims to operate a zero food to landfill policy and claims that all its sites run on 100% renewable energy. This all sounds great, and a less pedantic person might not go digging much further. Unfortunately, visiting the restaurant's website doesn't bring any answers to the table. None of the claims seem to be verifiable. Yes, there is a page titled Impact that's devoted to the restaurant's sustainability efforts and a series of blog posts that lay out all kinds of sustainability-related initiatives and projects, but it's a hall of mirrors. None of these articles or pages lead to any actual data, to any certifications, or to any bona fide evidence of real action being taken. There's a link to something called the Sustainable Steak Movement, and this separate site contains a manifesto about the movement's commitment to, quote, "neutralizing the environmental impact of cattle rearing to offer carbon-neutral steaks and wines in our restaurants," end quote. But the only link that promises to show me any actual evidence of the work being done just takes me right back to the impact page on the first website, the one for the restaurant. I've clicked around for a long time. I get nowhere. This is not a good look. Now, I want to be open-minded. It could be that this chain of steakhouses is doing some brilliant work. However, regardless of whether that's the case, we are unable to qualify any of the claims that they've made. They are greenwashing, plain and simple. They shouldn't be making claims associated with sustainability, full stop. But does the responsibility lie solely with the restaurant in this case? Well, no, I don't think so. We increasingly see marketing and advertising agencies getting called out for the greenwashing that they enable for their clients. So why would those emerging norms not apply to this magazine too? considering conversations with some previous Communicating Climate Change guests like Alexandra Borchardt, Harriet Kingaby, Catherine Dunn, and Jenny King, I think they would place quite a bit of responsibility on the journalist and the magazine to do the necessary research and investigation to ensure they're not spreading misinformation, which, as far as I can see, is exactly what they've done in this case. But how do we fix it? Well, first of all, if you're writing a piece about sustainability or otherwise amplifying the quote-unquote green claims of a company or product, do your due diligence. Ask questions. Conduct research. The onus is on you as a journalist, as a platform, to bring the audience a slice of truth. As for the restaurant, stop using green claims to try and stand out from the crowd. If you aren't substantiating the claims you're making, whether you're legitimately able to or not, you don't have the right to be using them. Until you can provide the audience with a clear basis for those claims, so data, accreditations, sources of truth that they can check easily, then you cannot use those claims. Better stick to another differentiator, like the flavor, price point, quality, etc., of your product instead. But what do you think? What's your perspective? What have I missed? Do you agree with my assessment of this scenario, or do you have a different take? You can leave a response at communicatingclimatechange.com, either by filling out the contact form or by leaving a voice message on the call-in show page. There's a link to that in the show notes. All right, what's next?
Hi there, it's Joseph Guelfer here. I just wanted to note that The Guardian has another of its Trump derangement syndrome articles out talking about how Trump is turning climate into a culture war. And this article unwittingly teaches us some powerful climate communications. So the article bemoans that the Republicans are seeking to push through this anti-climate legislation with what it implies are silly names. Number one, Liberty and Laundry Act. Number two, the Refrigerator Freedom Act. Number three, the Clothes Dryer Reliability Act. But the reality is that language such as liberty, freedom, and reliability lands with voters. So progressives and climate communicators, who in most circumstances are sane people, really have two choices. Number one, engage in a reactive process of trying to respond or to debunk such discourse, assuming people are rational actors. Quick hint, this does not work. It's going to consume all of your time and effort. Number two, engage in a proactive process where you start incorporating such language into your positive climate agenda. So I think ultimately this boils down to whether progressives are more interested in pursuing the way they think communication should work or the way communication actually does work.
Right, so Joseph is pointing to something that seems to be beeping ever louder, at least on my radar, and that's a tendency to underestimate the potency, the power of the communications coming out of conservative and right-wing sources. In my conversation with John Marshall, we heard a lot about how simple, value-driven messages, just like those being taken up by the Trump campaign, are what's missing from quote-unquote progressive campaigns. Reading through this Guardian article that Joseph is flagging, and other ones, I have to reflect on my discussion with Thomas Coombs too. He channeled Annette Schenker Osario with the line, "If you fight it, you feed it." Although putting energy into pointing and laughing at the language of our opponents might seem constructive, as Thomas rightly pointed out, it means less time and energy spent on presenting our offerings, our values, our policies, our plan. In ridiculing someone else's vision, we risk making conspicuous our lack of one. It seems to me as if the people at the reins of these conservative campaigns are ticking plenty of boxes for success when it comes to creating simple, resonant messages for their audiences, something I think has been lacking in the campaigns coming from left-wing, progressive, climate-centric camps. A case in point here is Project 2025, a regressive mess of policy that would be sure to do more harm than good to the lives of those being primed to support it, and which I've seen widely lamented, ridiculed, and lambasted across media and feeds that I subscribe to. The result of all the knee-jerk condemnation of the likes of Project 2025 and the policies raised in this Guardian article is that all we hear about is Project 2025 and the policies raised in this Guardian article. Meanwhile, as Thomas puts it, our agenda dies. We've gotten pretty quick at shooting down climate doomerism, for example, for not producing any solutions and only focusing on the negative, yet here we are, falling into the same trap. Past Communicating Climate Change guests like Florencia Luhani, Tori Stevens, Wawa Gatheru, and more have flagged the failure of the climate movement to adequately include and effectively engage huge swathes of people who might otherwise hop on board. We're failing to deliver a vision of the future that speaks to everyone. We're failing to use language and values that resonate across the board. We're failing to employ frames that engage people and bring them into our movement. We're failing to present tangible, desirable futures that reflect the needs of all voters. So I'm with Joseph on this one. Laughing at the Trump supporters didn't help us last time. It's unlikely to do so again. So how do we fix it? Well, first off, stop underestimating our opponents. They're really good at this. They have few scruples and they have massive budgets. Next, stop feeding what we're fighting. Framing expert George Lakoff tells us never to engage with our opponents' frames. We should not be accepting their version of reality, even to refute it. Instead, we have to deliver our own alternative vision for the future. That's how we gain ground, not by wriggling around in the quicksand of someone else's proposal. We talk a lot about storytelling in this climate communications world. Well, it's time to get on with it. Help us imagine a vision of the future that speaks to everyone, a vision that anyone, not just those of us in this climate bubble, can get behind. This is the job we have to do. We in the climate camp, in contrast to our opponents, are the ones most likely to appeal to science and data in our work. We kind of pride ourselves on that. And yet, when that same science and data is telling us to shake up our approach to communicating climate and a slew of other important policy issues that intersect with it, as has been the case for the last couple of decades, we seem to be sticking our fingers in our ears, running the same old plays, and getting frustrated at the lack of progress. In the very first episode of the Communicating Climate Change podcast, social change scholar Susie Moser told me that when it comes to communicating climate change, there are ways to do it better and ways to do it worse. And we've been doing it worse for a long time. In fact, I started this podcast to shine a light on the quote-unquote better and help us all do more of it. If you're interested, I actually put together a foundational course on the topic over on the Creators for Climate Community Hub. There's a link to that in the show notes. But what do you think about the language of the right? What's your take on Project 2025? What kinds of things need to be included in any kind of progressive vision for it to gain broad appeal? I'd love to hear your thoughts. All right, let's hear the next one.
Hi, I saw this headline from the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication, and I thought about you. It says that 37% of registered voters in the U.S. are pro-climate voters, but doesn't it really give the impression that the other 63% are anti-climate voters? I don't think it's what they meant, but it doesn't send a great message. What do you think?
Oh, this is a good one. I also subscribe, as I'm sure many of you do, to the Yale Program on Climate Change Communications newsletter. If you don't, I recommend jumping on the bandwagon. So much good stuff from some of the best players in the game. But in this case, our caller does have a point. Thinking back to my conversation with Marcos Pelinor from the Behavioral Insights team, I can't help but be reminded of his example of how clumsy communications around norms can actually have unforeseen consequences, in particular, backfire effects. Marcos shared that often, in an effort to shine light on a problem, we might be tempted to state how bad it is. The example he gave was, imagine 90% of teens are smokers. Well, if you start running a campaign that highlights how 90% of teens are smokers, sure, you'll show a lot of people the scale of the problem. But crucially, you'll also tell the 10% of teens who aren't already smoking that they're out of step with their peers. Social norms are powerful things, so the backfire effect is that you might end up encouraging more teens to start smoking by making them aware of the fact that they aren't moving with the herd. The newsletter headline that landed in my inbox stated, quote, 37% of registered voters are pro-climate voters, end quote. For me, as for the person who left this voice message, this was an arresting thing to read. The implicit message there is that everyone else, 63%, the vast majority, is an anti-climate voter. Yikes. Of course, digging into the associated article and the details of the survey that these insights came from, the picture is quite different. People taking part in the survey were faced with 28 policy issues, one of which being global warming. They had to select the importance of these issues to their voting behavior in the upcoming presidential election. Options were very important, moderately important, a little important, not at all important, or not sure. They were also asked in a separate question if they preferred a candidate who supported or opposed action on global warming. So what makes a pro-climate voter in the eyes of this study? Well, it's someone who rated global warming as very important and said they preferred a candidate who would take action on it. But what about people who stated that global warming was moderately important to them in the upcoming election, and who also preferred a candidate who supported action on global warming? Were they pro-climate? They sound pretty pro-climate. Nope. Where the respondents said global warming was moderately important, or even not important at all, if they didn't check the box that global warming was a very important issue to them, they were put in a bucket labeled global warming is not very important. That's quite a loss of context. So this headline and the subject line of the newsletter that landed in who knows how many inboxes, which carries the impression that most people aren't pro-climate, completely skims over the fact that an additional 25% of people who took part in the survey preferred a candidate who would support action on global warming. That's a total of 62% of people who preferred a candidate who supports action on global warming, literally the opposite of the impression the headline delivers. Kevin Green from social change organization RARE told me in our interview, quote, "If you tell me that only 1% of Americans think climate action is important, I'm going to think there's something weird about that 1%. And more importantly, that it's more socially acceptable for me to side with the 99%. End quote. How many people read more than the subject line of an email or the headline of an article they see on social media? How many people came away from this with the impression that climate voters are in the minority? We know that a great deal of misinformation around climate emerges not only from bad faith content, but also from unclear climate communication. And this headline delivers a particularly unfortunate and easily misunderstandable message as we cruise towards the presidential election in November. So, how do we fix it? Considering the data suggests that only 15% of voters considered global warming to not be very important and preferred a candidate who would not act on global warming, maybe lead with that figure. Or even better, aggregate the data differently. Someone somewhere made a choice about what counts as a pro-climate voter, just as someone made a choice about bundling everyone who didn't tick the very important box into the same not very important bucket. These choices didn't change the results of the survey, but they nevertheless shape our perceptions of those results. So, how many people said climate was not at all important and would prefer a candidate who would oppose action on global warming? Highlighting this minority would be true to the data without being quite so counterproductive. Alternatively, considering how many years the team at Yale have been running these surveys, they might find some patterns in the data gathered over longer time periods. Are there more pro-climate voters this time round than at the previous election? Kevin Green also explained, quote, "Telling people that something is becoming more normal is almost equally as effective as telling them something is normal, because we want to go where the herd is going. So, if you show us where the herd is going, we want to go and meet them there." End quote. We really don't have to make things harder for ourselves. Being cognizant of the perceptions people might form from headlines can save us from hiccups like this one. But what do you think? How do you perceive statistics like this? Would you have dug deeper or just taken the stats from such a credible source at face value? And if so, how would that make you feel? Well, that's all we've got time for in this Communicating Climate Change call-in show. It was a lot of fun to try something different this time. But what in particular stuck with you from this episode? What will you take from it and apply to your own work? Thanks to everyone who left a message since my initial call for submissions. I obviously couldn't get through all of them this time, but keep them coming, and maybe in a future call-in show, yours will be featured. You can find links to some relevant resources in the show notes, including a link to the call-in page on communicatingclimatechange.com, where you can submit your own voice message. Whether it's a climate communications example, question, issue, or challenge, or a response to something you heard in this or another episode of the podcast, I'm excited to hear what's on your mind. As always, thanks for listening to Communicating Climate Change. If you enjoyed this episode, why not leave it a rating or a review? Your feedback lets me know what to focus on, what to improve, and how to continue producing the kind of content that you find valuable. It also boosts visibility, meaning the series reaches more people, expanding the community, and driving the conversation forward. After all, that's what it's all about. You can find more episodes wherever you get your podcasts, or by subscribing, so you never miss out. You can find Communicating Climate Change on LinkedIn too, and if you think the series would be of interest to friends or colleagues, why not point them in the right direction? Remember, Each and every episode attempts to add to our toolkits to help us develop the skills and the abilities that we'll need for this massive task. So be sure to stay tuned for more. For anything else, just head over to communicatingclimatechange.com. Until next time, take care.